Hello, hello, and welcome to The Thin Blue Mind. Each week we will be looking at current policing issues and topics within the UK. Our regular panel consists of Steve Bradshaw, who is a TV and theatre actor, Richard Horton, author, and me, Dave Thomas, broadcaster. What we all have in common is over 80 years of combined police service. Now retired, we will be providing opinion and insights from the unique position of having been there and done it. Steve spent the majority of his service on firearms before being promoted to inspector, where he was a force incident manager. Richard was a career detective before going back into uniform as a response sergeant. Myself, I spent the majority of my service on the Rhodes Policing Unit before going into CID and Child Protection. You may not agree with everything we say, but we will make you think. The Thin Blue Mind with Bradshaw, Horton and Thomas. Policing insights and opinion.
Well, hello, hello, and welcome to this week's episode of The Thin Blue Mind. We're going to be talking about the insidious offence of rape and its low conviction rates over the last few years within the UK courts, and we're going to be looking at why that might be. There's a lot to pick apart in this topic. We'll do our best to cover what we can in the time available, so we might have to rattle through a few things, but essentially rape convictions in the UK are not good. From the top performing force of charging 7.1% of all complaints to the lowest performing force of just 0.7% is pretty poor, and there's going to be all sorts of reasons for why that is, and we're going to discuss that.
The first thing that struck me was the very wide variation between charging rates between forces. That does suggest that some people have got a better process than others for gathering the evidence and getting sufficient evidence to court. It may suggest that through the whole complicated process, they may support their victims better. A major issue is victims dropping out of the prosecution before it ever gets to court, or even the CPS. The role of the independent sexual violence advisor, the ISVA, is key in this. Somebody that sits outside the police and outside the courts that will provide ongoing support to the victim. Of course, those services have been cut. I believe there's some additional funding for four courts areas to have better ISVA support. That's been lacking. Clearly to me, there is a problem when sort of 8% or so in one force and less than 1% in another force. That must reflect something happening that's not right.
Yeah, and I suppose it's important to point out, and a big thanks to Gavin Hales, who's using a lot of his statistics today. Rape investigations can take a long time to investigate, which is part of the problem, I suppose. And the figures are playing catch up with the charging rates, and there's be a lot of active investigations that have not yet been charged. So we have to put that caveat in with the figures. It was interesting, you've covered quite a few things there. The biggest thing that leapt out at me was, of all the disposals for the offence of rape, certainly towards the biggest area was the disposal of an evidential difficulty, i.e. the investigation has ended either because of lack of the victim support or, as we call in the police, evidential difficulties. And perhaps we could talk about perhaps some of the factors surrounding why victims might want to not see through an investigation.
Now, I know you two are very experienced in this role from your work in CID. I'm not. I've never investigated a rape. It's not been my speciality. What I've kind of heard third hand, both from the media and from within the policing service, has been relative changes, really, in evidential guidelines and disclosure guidelines, I believe, and what the police should and shouldn't be doing as a matter of course. Now, correct me if I'm wrong, we seem to, in the police in the past, like to tick boxes, don't we? We like to have an array of tactical options, to use a phrase that I'm used to, and gather information, gather as much evidence as possible, because we all know how difficult it is to get things past the CPS. For me, straight away, when I heard, you know, trawling people's phones and asking for phones to be read, and just doing a blanket sweep in many ways, that for me was trying to put myself inside the victim's shoes and thinking to myself, that's a little bit extreme. Because I know personally, if I was involved in something quite horrific as a victim, you're not getting my phone.
I can absolutely understand that. I can only say from background, I've had two cases where looking at the phone has been both assist the defence and undermines the prosecution, and strongly, to the point when you looked at the phone and you thought, well, this is not what we've been told. the phone tells a different story to what the victim is telling us. One in six rapes are stranger rapes. Five in six rape allegations are made in respect to somebody known to the victim. In these days, when we have everybody connected by Facebook and WhatsApp and Instagram and all the rest of it, most people have communication with each other. If there's some suggestion there is communication before or after, then it's important, I think, for an investigation to get the context of that. If nobody's raising it, if nobody's saying there was anything, then perhaps not so important. But knowing that I've had two victims who were convinced that what had happened to them was rape, but they were both historical accounts that were given, but also knowing that looking at the recorded conversation, communication on the phone, made it clear that was not what had happened.
I must say, and it's our experience, before the new guidelines came in, I think it was last year now, time's going on since we retired, before those new guidelines, basically we were on a little bit of a fishing trip, weren't we? And I have to say, I've never looked at a phone that's proved an offence of rape, but it has disproved one. I'm kind of torn a little bit because I've looked at phones where I've no real reason to, and yet I've found evidence that's massively undermining of an offence. And I think as investigators, when we're in the police, we kind of get a bit numb to the fact of what we're actually asking of people, don't we? And
if I could clarify particularly on this sort of material, I'm not talking about material that says, oh, the complainant lives such and such a lifestyle, or they have multiple partners. That's pointless. This is an offence where somebody has not given their consent. I've seen stuff that made it very clear that what we're looking at was regret after a sexual encounter rather than a lack of consent, that there was consent at the time, but I wish I hadn't. And so it's very, very tricky business. But I'm, as an investigator, never particularly bothered about how somebody lives their life or anything like that. That's none of my beeswax. What it comes down to is, did the complainant not consent to what happened to them? That's the key in the offence.
Okay, so as an outsider, can I say, from not investigating rapes, can I ask you off a question then? You mentioned there, Dave, about you've been able to disprove a rape via the messages. That, obviously, in your eyes, is as important as proving it, I suppose, because we are getting to the truth, aren't we? We are establishing what is...
Well, we're legally bound to as well.
Exactly, yeah. And so that has its positives in being able to disprove an account that's been reported to you. The question I'll have for you then, if there is an allegation of rape, I'm not talking about a stranger rape, but someone that's known, but you kind of don't think, and it's not raised, that there's some messages that are in play, you know, the quote, and it's not my words, the quote was asking for it kind of message. Would you have, or would you now, have asked for phone just to do the troll, just to do the I'm being as thorough as possible?
If it's not raised by the complainant, and as part of your process of speaking to the complainants and getting that first account, part of that is, was the communication beforehand? Was the communication afterwards? And if there was, then I'd want to see that. I'd want to verify that. And also the suspect interview. And one of the instances I was talking about, it came up in the suspect
interview. It's usually the suspect that raises it, isn't it?
And the suspect says, you need to see the messages before and you need to see the messages the next morning. And the victim had never raised those or never spoken about being in contact with him before or after. Mm. If it comes up and it's raised, then I want to see it and I want to verify it and I want to get the context for it because that's part of an investigation. Sure, as eggs, if it's come up in either the suspect interview or the victim account, the CPS are going to want to know what it is and what was said as well before they make a decision. They're a Confucian organisation, the CPS. They used to say, Confucius, if the cushion was not straight, the master would not sit. That's very much the way the CPS work. If the cushion's not straight, they're not going to give you a charging advice. So you need to dot the I's and cross the T's.
And we'll go into that a little bit later on. But I wanted to look at some of the factors that stop perhaps people either making a complaint in the first place or having made a complaint then decide that they're not going to go through with it. Obviously the shame of the offence itself, the fact that it may become public knowledge, and the court process itself and the delays inherent that we currently have.
Sometimes people just don't want to relive it.
Well, that's an important point, isn't it? Because some have said the court process was worse than the actual offence.
I think there was some work done a few years ago, and from my time in communications room, we looked into this and how many times we asked people to go through an account, right from the call taker to then to the person who gets allocated the crime, the response, immediate response.
It's a trained first responder.
Who goes, And then someone else goes, well, for me, just tell me. And I think it was numerous times people were asked to recount this. And when it's like, I told your colleague. And then you'll find that defence will get a copy of the tape and say, yes, but when you first initially did that, you said blue shoes. And now you're saying turquoise shoes. And they're trying to put fag paper in between people's accounts.
Within court, there are meant to be processes to protect a victim giving evidence in this sort of case. Judge is meant to offer them some protection from sort of hostile cross-examination. They're meant to have special measures potentially. I think the last report that was done into the court process was that CPS don't really go for special measures enough, we don't apply for special measures enough, and judges are not particularly great at preventing defence barristers from trying to take complainants' victims apart in the witness box. But by that point, we're already down into that 1% that ends up with a charge. We're really looking at the 99% or whatever where it doesn't even get that.
Yeah, and maybe we'll talk about the court bit afterwards.
Just before you wrap up on that element of it, I think we can't underestimate the fact that people sometimes just say, not only will I have to explain this, but I'm going to have to explain it to my husband. Mm. I'm going to have to explain it to my children, my parents, my friends. And I'm going to be, quote, the victim. I don't know how to say this, but some people will see it as, I'm just too busy to be a victim. I need to crack on with my life. And people think they can put it behind them. That's when the psychological element of it comes and kicks them up the backside. Victim trauma is big on this, and they look at stats. Intelligent people look at stats and say 4%, and I have to do what? And then they'll balance that up and go, ain't worth it.
The police and the CPS did a joint report in February 22, I believe, and one of the things that came out of that was that we're placing too much emphasis on the victim and not enough on the defendant. I can think of a particular example where it was an historic abuse within the family. It was a male victim. And the CPS, it was investigated. The CPS chose not to run it because when he was 15, he got into drugs and got into lying and all the rest of it that would perhaps discredit a witness. And you can look at it two ways, can't you? And the way the CPS looked at it was that the jury wouldn't believe him. He's too discredited. Whereas you could argue, well, isn't that proof that he's being abused? Because that was his way of dealing with it, and he went off the rails. So the very behaviours that were caused by the offence had stopped the prosecution. And it's a bit ironic and perverse.
There are real issues in that what you are trying, more often than not, is the account of one person against the account of the other. If there is forensic evidence, if there's semen or whatever, then it was consensual. We'll say the suspect. No, it was not. We'll say the victim. There will be no CCTV. There will be no third-party witness. You may get an early complaint, but that's a powerful thing. If somebody's disclosed to a friend or a family member shortly afterwards what's happened, that can be powerful evidence in favour of what the CPS will consider. But generally, when it gets down to the CPS making a decision, it will come down to one account against another account. Your job as an officer investigating it from the complainant side, you gather all the information, you get that early complaint stuff, you get an examination done to see if there are any injuries that would suggest a lack of consent, you get a video interview done with the victim so that their evidence in chief, if you will, can be given by video. They'll still be subject to cross-examination. You spare them having to recount necessarily what's happened because you can press play and there's their account. You gather everything that you can. You talk to people that they were with in the evening. You do the background investigation. And you do the investigation around the suspect, but generally what there is in the suspect, there may not be bad character. It will be, they know each other, they've known each other for a while. He says it was consensual. It becomes the classic he said, she said, but when you boil everything down, unless you're lucky with the first account and physical evidence and putting to CPS two accounts, and in a court, it's one account against another account. And that's very, very tricky business because there won't be a lot of evidence to go with it.
No, and like we've said before as well, you put it in front of a jury and it can sway on the fact that they like somebody in court. We've talked about this before, haven't we, how subjective juries are, and it can swing on something so minor. And when you've got a lack of evidence, conclusive evidence, to prove beyond that reasonable doubt, you're struggling, aren't you? And CPS know that, and CPS go, well, do we run it?
I've seen that happen where I've gone with cases, rape cases to court. I can think of two particular acquittals, and I was quite happy in my mind that there was a rapist stood in the dock, but the jury didn't go down that route for whatever reasons, which we'll never know, but they decided that he was not guilty.
We have this evidential threshold, don't we, which the CPS like to use and throw around. In some ways, that's irrelevant. It's the threshold of the jury. It's the jury you're having to convince, and I don't have any evidence of this, but I am sure that's what the CPS use a yardstick for and hide behind this evidential threshold test. It's what would the jury believe? What would the man in the street believe?
That's the system. I think I'm right. Till 2018, the CPS had a target of 60% success in rape trials,
which was kept
very
quiet,
and once exposed, was dumped. So to be fair, they're not operating under that now, but we've had a good long period of time during the 2010s when that's been the case.
So you're talking 60% of those that they authorised charge on?
Yes.
So things were getting dumped early doors.
Well, the suggestion is you would only prosecute the strong cases, wouldn't you?
Yeah. So the ones where you think, you know what, we might get this home, we might not, would get dumped pre-charge because it would affect performance indicators.
Yes, it would.
Wow.
It happened. We've all lived through red, amber, green. You know, you look at the stats, you're either red or you're amber or you're green when you go to speak to the chief inspector. And the CPS, no doubt, had the same issues. Like the police, they've suffered huge budget cuts and huge staffing cuts over the last 10 years. So you've got fewer people making more decisions, and that can't be good.
2010 to 2011, 8,094 full-time equivalent CPS staff in post.
Yeah.
2020 to 2021, there were 5,419. That is a massive cost.
Yes.
And that doesn't
huge.
Take into account the fact that those lawyers that have been replaced by less experienced lawyers.
Yeah, of course.
And that probably actually quite nicely takes us on to some of the perhaps the factors that affect why suspects aren't charged with rape. I think 1 in 77 suspects are charged is the current rate. So looking at some of the factors, inexperienced frontline police officers and detectives, that's part of it. I know there's a high CPS vacancy rate, just discussed the loss of experience. A bit of a risk aversion, perhaps from this police and CPS, and we talked about that, didn't we? The 60% conviction rate that was kept quiet, so getting rid of the less certain cases, shall we say. Also the fact now that case files, that when you do go to CPS, it has to be a full file, very basically, previously you could go with a partial file and get a steer from CPS of a yes or no. Now you've got to do all the work as though it were going to trial for them to say yes or no. So that takes time. I think only 2 out of 5 police forces now have a specialised RASO unit, a rape unit. Lancashire used to have one, they got rid of it. But to be fair, certainly in the west of the county, nearly every job on the night note was a rape. So everybody became an expert in it, although the RASO units are being brought back. And certainly large court backlogs is a problem, isn't it, at the moment?
It is a major problem. I think Secret Barrister, Barrister Secret, was making a point of this. When these 4 trial courts came out with the additional support for victims, he said the problem is all the other courts where there isn't support for victims, where there's huge backlogs of cases because there's not been enough judges appointed to fill the courtrooms. There's been some problems with COVID. Now we've got a barrister strike. We've got fewer and fewer barristers because the criminal barristers are dropping out like flies because the junior ones can't make a living out of it. Mm. It's a mess. And it's a whole load of factors coming together. It doesn't just affect rape. It affects everything that goes to the Crown Court. It's been run down like everything else in the criminal justice system. Yeah, your victim will have to wait 2.5 years, potentially, before they even get to trial.
What I'm saying, isn't it? Justice delayed is justice denied.
Learned hands.
2.5 years, if it was an assault, if I'm the victim of assault or a burglary or something, that's impactive enough. But if I was the victim of a rape and I'm waiting 2.5 years, there'd be some point in that 2.5 years where you think, sod this.
Well, let me throw this at you. Imagine you've been waiting 2.5 years to get to your trial date and you find out it's a floating trial and it gets adjourned to the following year. And that's happened. Imagine how the victim feels then. I really don't know how they go through with it. I really don't.
And there comes a point with victims where you must think, that's it, I've had enough. I'm going to have to look after myself or look after my family. I'm bidding this, get it behind me.
And to their credit, I think CPS have got better at accepting that. There used to be a little bit of, well, we started, so we're going to finish. I remember a case where the victim became suicidal at the thoughts of going to court. CPS were still up for running it. Until we had a doctor's letter and a psychiatric examination to them saying, you run a real serious risk of this person killing themselves if you continue to run this trial and you force them to give evidence. Mm-hmm. I think there's more acceptance now. This was 10, 12 years ago, but there's more acceptance now that victims will drop out. Yeah, you're right. They have that time to think about it. Will I get torn to shreds in court? Will I be portrayed as a bad person in court? Will I lose at court? Will I not get justice at court? I've been left on my own for 2.5 years, no support, no backup. The detective that's working my case has got 10, 20, 25 similar cases.
Or has moved on and somebody else has picked it up.
Absolutely.
Which happens all the time in the cops.
Absolutely it does. The attrition rate, I believe, is horrendous as well. Mm. From the people that get to the point where they're there's been a charge, a suspect is charged, they have some nebulous date in the future for court, but then they're just left to stew. And that can't be right either. The amount of support that should begin to the victim should be appropriate to what they need, and it's not.
Well, we have the ISVA service, don't we? Independent Sexual Violence Advisors, who are worth their weight in gold. But yes. Again, like everything else, it's a hit and miss service. In some parts of the country are really good, and other parts aren't.
So let me ask a really basic question for someone who, since joining Firearms, didn't really go to court that often. Is every court, that every type of offence that gets put towards Crown Court treated in equal merit? And what I mean by that is the scheduling of an assault or whatever the same as rape? Or do we have different categories, or should we have different categories to say, okay, this rape is now getting towards the threshold that we've established of 12 months, say, or 18 months, whatever we decide, and say, right, it's got to go in, we're bumping, because we're a Cat A offence, or whatever phrase you want to use, that's a Cat A offence, it's bumping that burglary, that assault, and we're having that trial date, and we'll bump that one forward. That one can wait, the Cat A one can't. We need to get him in.
I don't know that happens, but...
No, I don't think it does.
No. I think you can see it happen around homicides. Still, those tend to get on fairly promptly.
No, I think it's in the pecking order of... the offence was committed, really. You know, the seriousness of it really doesn't come into the timetable of when it hits court, unfortunately.
We're quite good at doing victim impact statements for court, aren't we? And how the offence has impacted on the victim, etc. Mm-hmm. How about how the actual process of justice impacts on the victim? Perhaps we need that to be assessed.
If you look at the attrition rates, that process of justice and waiting for justice does have a definite effect. People, complainants, drop out.
The experience of people going to court as a victim has been pretty shocking and horrendous, to be honest with you, and I wouldn't wish it on anybody. And, you know, the amount of times I've had an investigation, somebody just going as a witness, they only ever go once.
That's
because
true.
They go, I am not going through that again. We've got to change that at the courts.
If I've heard that once, I've heard that 1,000 times at Crown Court.
Yes.
And the guy's saying, this is the fourth time they've called this up. This was burglary with intent to rape. Serious offence, yeah. If you will. And he had seen the victim screaming from a window. Fourth time it was up, he'd had to take a day off work for each of the days he was called. They'd called the trial for a day when no judge was available. And he said to me, I've lost my job. I've been taking too much time off. Boss isn't understanding. And they're not even going to hear the case today.
But, I mean, it's not that there's lots of things in place that the courts can do, isn't it? I know, I refer to this joint report that was done by the police and CPS, that a fairly recent addition now to special measures is the Section 28, which is a pre-recorded cross-examination, which I've seen it in action, and it's an absolute godsend for the victim. And it's just not being used nearly enough. And I think part of that reason is that the courts aren't technically set up to do it.
It is still not uncommon for very adversarial cross-examinations, quite aggressive cross-examinations. It's not meant to happen.
No.
But it does. There's very little good in the court process. I guess, again, I can think of a couple where there's been acquittals. You go and you speak to your victim afterwards. Both times it's been, well, I had my day in court at least. We got the evidence out there, we did what we could. And you can look them in the eye and know that they've had a decent quality of service from the investigation. Mm. And they know they've had a decent quality of service in the investigation, but it's not been enough to get it home at Crown Court.
And I think it's closure, isn't it? A lot of victims say, well, at least they've got some closure now.
Yeah.
But that's not to say, and I hear officers say, well, perhaps now you can move on.
No, I cringe.
When officers say that to people, I really do. Well, let's have a look then at the difficulties in finding the evidence. You touched on it earlier, yeah. Richard. Basically, I think the vast majority of rapes, the offender is known to the victim. Stranger rapes, I would say we probably have a very good detection rate because there's forensic evidence, there's a scene, sometimes there's witnesses, the parties aren't known to each other. So really, consent isn't an issue. And that is the sticking point in these offences, is the consent, basically. Forensics become irrelevant because 9 times out of 10, when you're doing your disclosure for your interview, the solicitor will ask her, oh, is there any forensics? And say, well, yes, we've done forensics. The best defence you can do is put yourself at the scene.
Absolutely.
If you don't deny that you haven't had sex with somebody, forensically we can prove you have, because then you are going to get charged with rape and probably get convicted. Yeah. So that's the issue, isn't it? Where, yes, I did have sex with the complainant, but it was consensual. And as you say, Steve, there's rarely a witness to that. And this is why I suppose CPS are then looking for anything that's undermining.
I think you look for things that are supporting. But whilst you're doing that look, sometimes you will come across stuff that undermines the prosecution and or assists the defence. And you've got the duty to disclose that as much as anything else. But that's a proper, thorough investigation where you're testing the accounts, you're seeing what supports the victim's account, if there's an account given by the suspect, what supports their account. In the end, I suppose, asking the CPS to come to a decision on it when you've got all the evidence together. It's not a perfect system, because more often than not, it comes down to one account against another account, and you don't necessarily have all that good supporting evidence to go with it. And those are the, and I say weaker cases, not to say that somebody hasn't been raped, but weaker in that there is less supporting evidence for them having been raped. Those are the ones, I think, that fall by the wayside with the CPS.
A common scenario that I've come across is where a couple have been engaged in sexual intercourse, and then at some point the victim will say, no, stop now, I've had enough.
Yeah.
And they don't stop. That becomes rape. I think members of the public, and of which members of the jury are made up of, have a real problem with getting their heads around that one.
Some fairly traditional attitudes out there.
Yes.
In some juries. They talk about rape myths, and they're sort of commonly, and well, it's not fair to ask him to stop once he started, or she dressed provocatively, so she must have wanted it. You know, that sort
all
of
that
thing.
All that nonsense.
Yes, and there's been some work done to educate lawyers and judges and police officers.
There's been some awful attitudes from judges in the past, haven't there?
There have been, yeah. But some awful attitudes from police officers as well. Mm. And we need to get past that. It's a crime of lack of consent. You can deal with other aspects of it through sentencing, perhaps. That would be the place to say, not that it's great mitigation, but we started and she said stop and I didn't, and I was overcoming the moment. That's perhaps a thing for a judge to consider in sentencing. But we do need to get past the sort of myths of rape and just get down to, did that person who was raped give consent? Was it reasonable for the person to think that there was consent, or did they not? That's the question of facts, if you will. It doesn't matter how they were dressed. It doesn't matter whether they've been kissing or intimately touching or whatever in the run-up to it. It boils down to consent.
All right, Steve, I'm going to ask you to put your actor's head on now. I'm going to ask you to imagine that you are a rape victim and you have come to the police to report your rape. It's not an historical one. It's a fairly recent one. What sort of service would you expect from us?
It's the sensitivity, really. And not only put myself in the shoes, but I've got to think about a loved one of mine entering that system and how I would like them to be treated. I'm going to tell you something quite horrific and quite harrowing. For goodness sake, believe me. What I don't want is an officer crossing their arms, rolling their eyes and going, are you sure this happened? I get you have to challenge accounts, because that's what we do in the cops, don't we? But just believe me. And it's the emotional wreckage that I'm currently feeling. How much of that baggage am I taking forward? And just be understanding of what's happening to me is what I would say. Treat the person first and gather the evidence while you're doing it.
And I suppose that's probably one of the reasons why we perhaps should have specialised rape teams, is because officers will be attentive to everything that you've just mentioned.
Just from the police point, just for people listening, the first responder idea is we have officers, usually on the response teams, the blue light teams, who are trained to go and collect an early evidence kit, so the early available forensics from the victim, and to get a very basic first account, not to do any probing or questioning, but just get the very basic details so that it can be progressed by more experienced hands later, and to get them booked into a safe centre, which is a specialist medical examination centre where an examination can be done for physical evidence of injury and forensic evidence around contact. And it's important that we get that evidence quickly, particularly if it's forensic evidence, because it can be lost with the passage of time very quickly as well. And securing clothing, all those good early steps. And those officers are trained to do that.
But it's job stacking on the screen, isn't it?
Yes.
Yeah. And stuff. And you could be sat in someone's living room going through the most painful, traumatic episode of their life.
Yeah.
And no fault of a dispatcher. Are you free from that job yet? Are you free from that job at Smith Street? And it's like, yeah. Well...
Well, that's out of good supervision. Leave that officer alone. Yes, they're going to be tied up for the end of tour.
Write them off. Because when they come back, they're going to have a whole load of samples to book in. They're going to have a whole load of admin to do and getting a handover package ready for the morning.
I mean, we could go on and on and on about why rape convictions are so low. There's just so much to it. But what is clear is that victims just clearly are not getting the service they deserve.
Convictions are low for a number of reasons. One, as I said, because it often comes down to testing one account against another when it goes to the CPS. Two, we don't have adequate support in for victims between the charge point, shall we say, where there's a charge, and the court point, so we lose quite a lot there. I think also some allegations, there is such a paucity of evidence beyond the accounts that the CPS are going to be reluctant to charge on the basis of one account against another account without something else to back it up.
Have we set the bar too high, do you think, evidentially?
We've set the bar, I think, at what a jury, where a jury can have reasonable doubt. There's a general problem in society in that most rapes go unreported. So we only get the ones, really, where the victim feels strongly enough to report the rape. Most don't. So we've got this iceberg of unreported rape going on as well. There are many things that act as attrition, basically, along the way. And at every stage, there are reasons not to or reasons to drop out. Some of those we can address. Some of those we can't. Why not have a specialist team? You've got specialist murder teams, specialist homicide teams. Why not have detectives that are good at it? Independent sexual violence advisors, more of them, better funded. CPS, more rape and serious sexual offence qualified lawyers to make the decision, so we're not waiting so long for a decision. And courts, more judges operating in more courtrooms so that victims aren't having to wait as long for their day in court if they get their day in court. There's a lot of things we can do along the way that makes things better.
I think there's a lot of low-hanging fruit, isn't it? Like,
there really is.
When it's the little things that make a big difference sometimes.
Most of it's money, but not necessarily a huge amount of money in the grand scheme of things. The failure to successfully prosecute more than 1% of rapes or get more than 1% of rapes to court. We make a lot out of things that impact public confidence in the police service. And you can't investigate and you can't prosecute rape. That's a real sore spot for us. Because we should be able to. Some of it's out of our hands, but a lot of it's in our hands. You talk about the low-hanging fruit.
I'm a bit torn between my head and my heart here. My head says we don't lower the bar. Under no circumstances should that bar be lowered. The criminal justice system has a duty as well to the accused, should I say. I know we're very victim-focused on this.
No, that's a good point.
Which is right. We have to protect the integrity of the justice system for the accused as well.
Yep.
So that bar has to be as high. My heart says, well, there's not many third-party witnesses behind a bedroom door.
No,
so evidentially, you're going to struggle. And also rape. Tell me another offence that is more serious than rape where the victim is still alive. There isn't for me.
No.
So why can't we fast-track it like we do murders?
Well, there's some argument for specialist courts now, aren't they, for rapes, with specialist advocates and judges that are experienced in dealing with sexual offences.
If someone accused me of rape and I hadn't done it, imagine the turmoil that would have on my life.
Absolutely.
Because your name would get out, wouldn't it? And you with your family, with your neighbours, your job, your life, you'd just get decimated. You get absolutely destroyed. And then 2.5 years later, when you get found that actually you didn't do it, or it wasn't proved, oh, that's forgotten about, isn't it? Sorry, but you've already wrecked my life. So we do have to think about the accused in many ways and the impact it has on them as well as the victim by having it go on for 2.5 years.
It's a really, really difficult one, isn't it? But I think we're all in agreement that the low conviction rate is, it's appalling. And I don't know whether that's because it's just simply such a difficult offence to prove, whether the threshold to prove it is set too high, the cultural attitudes we have. We could go on and on and on, couldn't we?
It's no one thing. It is a whole lot of factors in policing, in the CPS, in the court adversarial system that we've got, in the way that we gather and present evidence, in the myths that society believes in places around the rape myths, as they're called. All of those things operate together almost uniquely in rape allegations, rape cases, and they do operate against the victim.
The Thin Blue Mind with Bradshaw, Horton and Thomas. Policing insights and opinion. Well, that's it for this week. Thank you for joining us. This podcast is in partnership with Policing TV, the leading policing media channel. So until the next time, on the next podcast, take care.